Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Welcome again here on Circles of Change. And as you know, frequent listeners, how much we enjoy scanning the horizon, including a global one, to find interesting guests who'd like to share their thoughts on change in their business endeavors. So it's a real pleasure. We're speaking with Jeremy Dean now in the United Kingdom. Good morning, Jeremy.
Hi. Good to be with you.
Actually, it's good evening there, right?
It is. That's right.
That's wonderful. I have in front of me a copy of Jeremy's newest book, and as a brief introduction, he's a psychologist and a creator of PsyBlog, which is a popular and insightful website that analyzes psychological studies that are truly relevant to everyday life. The book I have in front of me is called Making Habits, Breaking Habits, with a cups of coffee on the cover, but orange juice in the very corner. And the subtitle is Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Change Stick. So, Jeremy, just the whole concept of you starting your blog on PsyBlog, how'd that come about?
Well, I started studying psychology, it seems like an age ago now, and I started writing about it at the same time, partly because I think other people got just fed up with me telling them about studies. You know, as I learned about new studies, I'd go up to people and go, wow, have you heard about this cool new study? And they'd go, oh, no, here he goes again. So I thought I'd better start a blog and kind of get my enthusiasm out that way and save my friends and family from it.
Well, and I think, of course, those of you that come with the scientific background to back up your claims, you can lose people real quick at that as well. So my guess is your blogging also helped you to learn how to reframe and communicate in a way for a broader audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so important, isn't it, to make your communication clear. And that's one of the things about academic articles that I always found very difficult. My first degree actually is in law. Mm-hmm. And that drove me crazy, studying law for 3 years, because when lawyers write textbooks, they write kind of whole pages that are just one sentence with all these little subclauses in. And they seem to be trying to torture you and make it as confusing as they possibly can. So
they would call it influencing skills, though. But go ahead.
Well, I don't know. In those textbooks, just influencing me to fall asleep.
Yeah.
But the real thing is, it's just to kind of, you know, my style is very short sentences and communicating clearly. So that's always very, very important to me.
But you also know that when in Rome, you have to talk like the Romans. So for you to have done your work as a psychologist, you needed to be able to read, if not write, in the vernacular of psychologists. But now to really come back full circle, if I could use my analogy for the name of this show, to put it in a place, though, that the general public can understand, and that both there's the entertainment factor, because you all know we need that more these days, I guess, but to really bring these topics, like the one you've selected for this book about habits, in a way that people say, oh, I get it, and oh, most importantly, I can take action on this now.
And the thing that started me off on this book was writing a post on my blog, which was entitled, How Long Does It Take to Form a Habit? Mm-hmm. And I tried Googling that, and Google came up with this 21 days.
Absolutely. Yep, magic 21 days.
The magic 21 days, which turns out to be almost totally unfounded. and there has been some research done at University College London, and they got people trying to ingrain relatively simple habits, and they found a huge variety, anything from 2-3 weeks up to months and months. There was one guy in the study who was trying to do some sit-ups, I think, and he just couldn't get the habit. But they did find that the average over all of them was 66 days. So, what's that? It's just over 2 months, isn't it? So it's showing that perhaps it's going to take a little bit longer to ingrain, you know, the average new habit than you might imagine. So,
but I like working with 21 because that gives me some hope, right?
Yeah.
That gives me some hope. So let me fool myself into it. But I think, to be serious, and for our listeners, this is why your book is so important, is you went and made sure the facts you would rely upon truly were backed up from a research standpoint.
Yeah, well, my background's in research, you know, and I've been studying psychology for many years. And, you know, I have to back up everything I say with a study. You know, it has to be based on people who've been through this research. And what I say is really, in my book, it has anecdotes in it, but really it's based on lots and lots of data. You know, thousands, tens of thousands of people have been through all these studies, and all these little things have been tested out, and so I'm trying to just rely on those things that have been actually scientifically tested.
Well, the name of your book, Making Habits and Breaking Habits, it's a wonderful, you know, two bookends for what has to happen in the middle. And in many regards, what you're saying is, in order to make a habit, in many ways, it involves having to break habits. Or the flip of that is, if I want to be bound and determined not to eat chocolate, heaven help me, right after Valentine's Day here in the States, it is as much as my needing to envision what that new habit could be, right?
Absolutely. And I think one of the mistakes, or one of the kind of slip-ups that people sometimes make when they're trying to change their habits is suppressing, mm-hmm. you know, the thing that you're trying to stop doing, you know, like don't think about chocolate, don't think about cake, or in my case, which is one of these sort of long-running bad habits that I quite often have to fight with, is don't check my email, you know. So it's all about trying to replace that bad habit with something good, or at least neutral. Mm-hmm. And because this kind of suppressing, kind of pushing the bad habit out of mind, doesn't seem to work so well. So much better to replace it with another habit.
So you're telling me that today you feel good about having lost your mobile device so you can't check your email. Is that correct?
Well, I'm good.
I set a trap.
Well, you know, I've heard people saying that they know it's rude yeah. to check their email while they're having a conversation with someone. But, you know, we all know someone who does it. Normally, it's young people quite often. But even people who've got on a little bit in life are starting to sort of look down at their mobile phones during conversations. We all know it's rude, but it's kind of so tempting, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. But to break yourself of the habit, I recall reading an article in one of the high-end leisure magazines about this one hotel where you had to pledge and you had to turn over your mobile devices when you checked in. So that was almost like a dry-out clinic. And then they interviewed with great resolve people as they talked about what a refreshing 2 days they had without their device. You know, and then if you go and talk to, I've got very dear friends who went for 3 weeks on an African safari, and they're on the other side of having to work every day from a financial standpoint. But they said it was the most important 3 weeks they had, not just to enjoy the outdoors and so on, but they realized how all this constant communication wasn't as productive or necessary as we make it out to be.
Mm. And it underlines really such an important thing about habits in general, and that's that our habits are cued off by our environments that we're in.
Yeah.
And we tend to do the same things in the same situations automatically and quite often without thinking. And it's so obvious when you go on holiday, when you're away mm-hmm. from all those normal sort of cues, you know, whether it's at home or whether it's in the office, suddenly it's like you've got to decide the whole time what you're going to do next. And you're much more perhaps mindful then, and you make much more mindful decisions about what you're going to do next because you're in an unfamiliar environment. So, yeah, the question is, of course, can you continue that sort of mindful behavior when you get back from holiday and back into your regular routines again?
That's right. For those of you who just joined us, we're speaking with Jeremy Dean, who's the author of SciBlog, a wonderful website. His new book, Making Habits, Breaking Habits, with the subtitle of Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Change Stick. So what you started us down that track of why we do things then is heavily influenced by our environment, probably our values and our beliefs. But are you also suggesting thus, Jeremy, if we really want to break a habit, we need to go back and really understand the why first?
Well, the why in the sense, the kind of local why, the situational why, I suppose, is really important in the sense that what is it in the environment that's kind of sparking you off to do something?
Right.
For example, if I go back to my email, what sparks me off to start checking my email is when I'm doing something, when I'm working, and then I get a little bit stuck,
mm-hmm,
or I get a little
mm-hmm.
bored, or something
yep.
like that. then it's kind of, so it's kind of a little break that I'm giving myself to check my email, but not really a very productive break. And something I've tried to sort of train myself to do is just get up from the computer and have a little bit of a walk around, look out the window, have a little tiny micro break or something like that, which is much better for you, really, than sitting staring at your email. So sometimes, you know, that those little kind of changes can be very useful.
And probably you can track back that some of your most profound thoughts or creative pushes or how you resolved a problem came as a result right after having that clarity from having taken a break.
Absolutely. And there's these great little studies coming out now showing that after you read something, if you take a little break, only a few minutes, something like that, then it can just help you consolidate that memory. And when people's memories are tested even a week later, something they've read and then taken a little break afterwards, they do recall better. So these kind of little breaks can work wonders.
Well, and if, from the context for our listeners who are involved in organizations, that's why this mania of having your Microsoft Day Planner have meetings that go from start to finish of your day with no breaks in between, you're missing the chance to have the meeting after the meeting, even if it's with your own mind, to reflect on what you've collected, what didn't happen, etc., to move into the next.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a very easy kind of habit to get into, the sort of habit of feeling busy and being busy the whole time. You know, if I'm not doing something, then I'm wasting my time. But actually, you're not wasting your time when you're not doing anything, because your brain does need these little rests. I mean, I've even heard that that's part of the reason why we blink so much. I don't know if you've come across this research. It's just quite new out, showing that we actually blink on average about 15 times a second. And we don't need to blink that much to lubricate our eyeballs. But apparently it just gives the brain like a little tiny micro break, and it adds up to about 10% over the minute. So it seems we do. Our brain just needs these little rests to keep it running smoothly.
Well, it also shows that really our body is doing things well in advance of our brain even knowing how to synthesize them. For example, you know, your comment about breaking habits or why we do the things we do, I'm getting agitated, or you know, your right leg really hurts, I've got to get up and move, that it can drive us to do things. Can you share, Jeremy, maybe a couple anecdotes that you've relied upon in your books, or leaders, you know, our readers can get a sense of what it's all about, of why we do things and why we don't? What about the why we don't part? An anecdote or a research study you relied upon in your piece here?
Well, I suppose the reason quite often why we don't do things, and I suppose this is why we don't do things that we want to do,
right,
is, I suppose, quite often down to motivation, really. And I suppose that's one of the things that's quite often lacking with these changes that we're so often trying to make in our lives. And there's a kind of interesting kind of motivational tip that comes from Jerry Seinfeld, who's just as famous here in the UK as he is in the US. And apparently, there's this story that a young and up-and-coming comedian asked him, look, how did you write so many fantastic jokes, and how did you achieve such success? And he replied, well, when I first started, what I did was I put a diary, I put a calendar up on the wall, and I said every day I have to write one joke. And every time I write a joke, I put a little cross on my calendar, and then I'm done for that day. And what you're trying to do is not break that chain. So every day you sit down and you write your joke and you put your little cross on the calendar, and you know, you've gone a little bit further forwards. And one of the cool things about this is it plays right into this idea about habits. You're trying to create these kind of routines, something that you do every day, even if it's not really, it doesn't really take that long to do. All these little crosses on the calendar, they all add up, you know, and
sure
you can
do.
Achieve, you know, quite something quite substantial even by only doing these little small things every day.
But, you know, your book, as you really kicked us off right here at the onset, that this misnomer of 21 days straight and then you'll get a new habit, that actually can be across multiple months with even some breaks in between. But the idea of just keeping your momentum going is how you're going to get it to stick.
Absolutely. And, there's some research coming out now showing that one of the ways that you can actually make this plan for yourself is something called an implementation intention. I'll give you an example of that from healthy eating. If you're thinking about, you know, increasing your healthy eating, then you can say to yourself something like, if I feel hungry between meals, then I will eat. eat an apple. Mm-hmm. And so there's this connection between if, which is, and then that, then there's a situation, and then the thing that you're going to do. And what that is, it's like a blueprint for your habit. You're telling your unconscious, you know, if I'm in this situation, then I'm going to do this. And you can use this for absolutely anything, you know, at home and at work. So you think, right, the situation, and now there's this action that I'm going to take in this situation. And what you know, there's like tens of thousands of people have been through these studies, and it does show that these implementation intentions work really well. And making this little plan in advance can be really, really very useful for people, and does tend to help them establish that habit right at the start.
The other part of this habit piece, because we've had several guests that have mentioned this in the context of changing their own behavior or changing organizations. I cite an example of someone who talked about how many years he'd been working with a whole variety of diet plans. I mean, everyone comes out, he's tried it, been there, done that. Sometimes they work. They definitely don't seem to stick, though. It wasn't until he really dwelt on your word, the intention, which was the reason I want to lose weight is so I can have a more active, engaging time with my young children, or that I can come off with a different energy when I have to give a presentation at work. Once he got anchored in the intention, he said, it was amazing how easy it was for me to walk away from eating, you know, chips, cheeseburger, and a Coke.
You're absolutely right. And it's so important to connect the two levels here. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I'm talking about these if-then plans, it's very low level, it's very kind of simple and day-to-day, but you absolutely have to connect that up with these sort of higher level ideas, you know, the reason that you're doing the things that you want to do. And you need both of those levels. You need that kind of motivation, that desire why you're doing something, but you also need this really specific plan about what you're going to do in a particular situation, because quite often what people do is they make very vague plans. And the problem with vague plans is that we tend not to follow through on them, I suppose. And also you can break down as well these kind of big goals. You know, if you've got a goal to, you know, get yourself a better job or something like that, then that's fine. But that does need to be broken down quite a lot into sort of, you know, these little specific actions that you can take.
Jeremy, part of your study to get prepared to write this book and the things you've unearthed, though, many times what people need, though, is a real solid tipping point to get on with it. Right. I mean, we say that personal change or even organizational change comes as a result of two things, either intense pain or the opportunity to see incredible opportunity. So how do people, you know, even the idea of, by the way, going to jeremydean.com and buying a copy of your book to start this, what's the tipping point, do you think?
Exactly as you say, really, that you need to change that balance between the things that are kind of pulling you backwards and the things that are pushing you forwards, I suppose. And psychologists quite often encourage people to do visualizations and think about the really the positive aspects of the change they're trying to make and those negative aspects. And actually what we find quite often is that people are very happy to think about all the positive aspects of the change they're trying to make, you know, and how wonderful it'll be, for example, when they start exercising or they get a new job or whatever it is. But we don't really like to think about the negative aspects. We don't really like to focus too much on the obstacles, because the obstacles are a bit depressing and tend to kill your motivation somewhat. But it seems from this research coming out that actually focusing on the obstacles is such an important part of the process. And there's now this process which is called mental contrasting, where you actually contrast those positive aspects with the negative aspects and the kind of obstacles that you're going to face. And what happens to people when they do that kind of contrast, like they write down the pros and the cons and they go, okay, can I actually do this? People either will give up on their plan if they notice that it's just not doable, or if they notice they can do it and they can cope with the obstacles, then it'll push them forward and give them more energy and push them on towards their goal.
Right. It gives them the resistance, but also doesn't it help them set expectations that along this journey, I'm going to need recovery plans and I'm going to need support. So they know to reach out for additional things, that kind of like the hands behind their shoulder blades.
And I think this is why it's so important to think about habit change as a real long-term process. It's not like a quick fix. It's not a diet, you know, one of these 21-day diets or something like that you're going to go on. You're thinking, look, I'm going to make these changes that are sustainable and that I can continue really for the rest of my life. And to do that, you do need to tweak things as you go along, because, you know, everyone's life's different, and what works for one person won't work for another. And so you need to kind of have that feeling, what's going to work for me? And if something doesn't seem to be working, you can make relatively small changes. I give you a really simple example from me, which was while I was writing the book, I was trying to get my flossing habit ingrained. And I've been fighting with for years, and it was a simple move for me from flossing in the evening to flossing in the morning, and then the habit stuck for me. And that really worked, you know. And I'm not saying that would work for anyone else particularly, but it did work for me. So those kind of little tweaks can be really important.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, are any of us that are involved in changing things, change our own behavior or in organizations, how often we keep grinding one gear to the right, push it to the right, push it to the right. And oh, by the way, if we just lifted slightly and let it snap back to the left, it might even engage. So that's a perfect example. So, Jeremy, over the years, your work on SciBlog.com, as well as Making Habits, Breaking Habits, now your new book, how is it you think you've changed the most by helping others change, besides your flossing regimen now?
Well, the main thing, really, is the sort of habit of writing, really. Ah. That's the thing that's taken me the longest to ingrain. That's a massive habit. You know, if I'd been in that study I mentioned earlier about where the average was 66 days, I would have been right off the other end of the scale. You know, years and years it's taken me, really, to ingrain that habit. And that does show that it can take a lot longer for some types of habits, but you can get there in the end. And the good thing about kind of the writing habit is it sort of gets me into the position of sitting at the computer ready to work. But it doesn't necessarily, you know, the words don't write themselves. I have to engage the conscious mind to to write stuff. But at least the habit gets me into the position to actually write. So that's really been the main kind of thing.
That's wonderful. And I think also, though, the fact that you're writing, that you chose to go the routes for blogs, which you now have to contend with these things called comments, such that this is really you being in conversation with people. So you're getting a lot more immediate feedback, maybe over a period of days, depending on how viral some of your blogs have had the opportunity to go. But wouldn't you say, though, that's kind of your support group, though, that's kept you on the track, or the expectation that, you know, where's Jeremy's next blog?
Yeah, and you do get that immediate feedback, and it's quite unusual for me, because I've spent the last, you know, 6-7 years blogging, and I've just had my first book published. And book publishing to me is frightening, because you write a book and then you have to wait about a year to get the feedback on it. I write a blog post and I can tell within maybe 10 minutes whether it's going to be successful or not. So, you know, you're looking at it's quite different lead times there.
So, your book, Making Habits, Breaking Habits, Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Stick, it came out in 2013 here, although I'm sure you circulated a few copies to select folks beforehand. So I'm sure you're not sitting here, though, waiting. Tell me about the feedback you've gotten on your book so far.
Well, generally quite good. You know, to my face. Yeah, I don't know what they're saying behind my back, of course.
And so have you gotten any, whoa, I wasn't expecting that type response, whether it be in the form of an email or a call or during an interview, that's really thought, that stumped the judge here?
Not particularly, I don't think. Not really, actually. Not something to stump me like that, no.
Well, then we got to get to work on that. So usually when I also speak to people who, like you said, that you've been blogging all these years and now the decision to write the book, I should ask you, what prompted you thus to write the book?
Well, it was this post that I wrote a couple of years ago about the how long does it take to make a habit. And that was really, there was a huge response to that. And I noticed that people were really interested in this idea of sort of ingraining habits and making them automatic and making our responses kind of, because what you're looking for really with habits is to not have that tussle with your willpower anymore. You're looking to kind of get away from that. You don't want every time, you know, for example, you're thinking about practicing the piano, you don't want to have to kind of have that fight. Oh, I've got to sit down. You just want it to be part of your routine. You know,
did you talk to my mom? That was exactly me being forced to take piano lessons for 10 years. You're absolutely right on.
I have that absolutely. I was, in quote unquote, you know, forced to take piano lessons, and which now I would, it would be fantastic. But, it's the motivation thing again, isn't it?
And it's also the timing of where we were. I'd much rather been hanging out with the guys, you know, playing with trucks outside or who knows what I was up to, which led me ultimately to engineering school. But you're absolutely right. Well, Jeremy Dean, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for giving us some of your evening time there in the United Kingdom. His new book, Making Habits, Breaking Habits, Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Stick. And also do follow Jeremy's blog, which is PSYBLOG. And I have a hunch that it's going to prompt you in new directions, whether it be books or additional venues. Jeremy, congratulations and thanks for contributing here on our show.
Thank you very much.
Have a great weekend. Thank you.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.